Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. The world watched, astonished, as FEMA and the Bush administration seemed to ignore the plight of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast during the devastation that Hurricane Katrina delivered. What, were they taken by surprise? FEMA was informed ahead of time what the certain result would be for New Orleans, as was Bush. And I quote, FEMA Director Mike Brown and Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff listened in on electronic briefings given by the Hurricane Center in advance of Hurricane Katrina slamming Louisiana and Mississippi, and were advised of the storm's potential deadly effects. It's not like this was a surprise. We had in the advisories that the levee would be topped. Chertoff told reporters Saturday that government officials had not expected the damaging combination of a powerful hurricane and levee breaches that flooded New Orleans. End of the quote from Media Info reports. Computer modeling done the year before, however, showed that even with a Category 3 hurricane, New Orleans was doomed, and this was certainly known to both FEMA and Homeland Security, as well as Bush. Not only had they been briefed, and the likely outcome well known, both the FEMA head, Mike Brown, and Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff seemed unaware of the suffering and plight in New Orleans that was front page headline news everywhere and dominated the TV stations. When interviewed live by CNN, they were both surprised to hear that dehydration in babies and young children was rampant among those stranded at the Superdome and Convention Center. One had only to turn on the TV to see the urgent need, which dominated the screen nonstop. And I quote from the New York Times, September 5, 2005. Fox News, normally highly deferential to the Bush administration, was skeptical. Chris Wallace, the host of Fox News Sunday, asked Mr. Chertoff, "Mr. Secretary, how is it possible that you could not have known on late Thursday, for instance, that there were thousands of people in the convention center who didn't have food, who didn't have water, who didn't have security, when that was being reported on national television?" End quote. Well, where were the airdropped food and water, for instance? Guess what? Delayed on orders from FEMA. And I quote from the Associated Press, September 7, 2005. Michael Brown, director of FEMA, sought the approval from Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff roughly 5 hours after Katrina made landfall on August 29th. He proposed sending 1,000 Homeland Security Department employees within 48 hours and 2,000 more within 7 days. The 48-hour period indicated for the Homeland employees was to ensure they had adequate training. Employees required a supervisor's approval and at least 24 hours of disaster training in Maryland, Florida, or Georgia. The same day Brown wrote Chertoff, Brown also urged local fire and rescue departments outside Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi not to send trucks or emergency workers into disaster areas without an explicit request for help from state or local governments. End of the quote from Associated Press. This FEMA memo was a leaked memo, by the way. What kind of training was FEMA talking about? The extent of the mismanagement can be sensed from this report from Atlanta. As New Orleans burned, firemen were being trained to hand out flyers touting FEMA services. And I quote from the Utah Press, September 6, 2005. As New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin pleaded on national television for firefighters, his own are exhausted after working around the clock for a week. A battalion of highly trained men and women sat idle Sunday in a muggy Sheraton Hotel conference room in Atlanta. Many of the firefighters, assembled from Utah and throughout the United States by FEMA, thought they were going to be deployed as emergency workers. Instead, they learned they were going to be community relations officers for FEMA, shuffled throughout the Gulf Coast region to disseminate flyers and a phone number, 1-800-621-FEMA. People who are search and rescue certified, paramedics, hazmat certified, sitting there having a sexual harassment class, while out there are still victims in Louisiana who haven't been contacted yet. FEMA told them not to talk to reporters. End of the quote from the Utah Press report. Then it turned out that Bush had not authorized federal aid for days, even though it was standing at the ready and waiting the release. Beyond failing to act, FEMA actually interfered with rescue efforts, turning back truckloads of water and food delivered by Walmart with a statement that they were not needed, and cutting communication lines from stranded local authorities. A quote from Aaron Broussard, the angry president of a Louisiana parish affected by the New Orleans flooding. This is a quote from NBC News, dated September 4, 2005. Mr. Broussard says, "Let me give you just three quick examples. We had a Walmart truck deliver three trucks of water, trailer trucks of water. FEMA turned them back. They said we didn't need them. This was a week ago. We had 1,000 gallons of diesel fuel on a Coast Guard vessel docked in my parish. The Coast Guard said, 'Come get the fuel right away.' When we got there with our trucks, they got the word, 'FEMA says, don't give you the fuel.' Yesterday, FEMA comes in and cuts all of our emergency communication lines. They cut them without notice. Our sheriff goes back in. He reconnects the line. He posts armed guards on our line and says, 'No one is getting near those lines.'" End of the quote. Why on earth would communication lines be cut? To prevent alternate rescue efforts from emerging, grassroots efforts? Bush held press conferences, photo opportunities, but was so late to the arena and so casual in his response, the world was stunned. And I quote from the New York Times, September 5, 2005. The Bush administration, normally so deft at staying a step ahead of the television cameras, spent the weekend trying to catch up. President Bush, who plans to make a second trip to the Gulf Coast today, a disaster mulligan, paid a quick visit to the Red Cross headquarters in Washington to thank the volunteers and publicly display his concern. Mr. Rumsfeld and Mrs. Rice visited the region to make the same point, but their news conferences were clouded by an outburst by Aaron F. Broussard, president of Jefferson Parish, who wept as he described on Meet the Press the drowning of a friend's mother who was left stranded in the St. Bernard nursing home for 4 days. "Nobody's coming to get us. The secretary has promised. Everybody's promised," Mr. Broussard said. "They've had press conferences. I'm sick of the press conferences. For God's sakes, shut up and send us somebody." End of the quote from New York Times. If FEMA is a poor performer under the Bush leadership, well, actually under both Bush presidencies, under President Clinton, it was different. And I quote from the LA Times report, dated September 5, 2005. FEMA was created in 1979 in response to criticism about Washington's fragmented reaction to a series of disasters, including Hurricane Camilla, which devastated the Mississippi coast 10 years earlier. The agency was rocked by scandal in the 1980s and turned in such a poor performance after Hurricane Andrew struck South Florida in 1992 that President George Herbert Bush is thought to have lost votes as a result. But according to a variety of former officials and outside experts, the agency experienced a renaissance under President Clinton's director, James Lee Witt, speedily responding to the 1993 Mississippi flood, the 1994 Northridge earthquake, and other disasters. End of the quote from LA Times. In 2005 with New Orleans, Charges of racism were raised. The internet abuzz with rumors that it was the intention to kill as many people in New Orleans as possible, and thus the reasons for the delays. But per the Zetas, none of these were the real reasons for the delay. But first, some background on FEMA. Desire for a dictatorship is not new. Called the New World Order by none other than George Herbert Walker Bush during the first Gulf War, and I quote, "The world can therefore seize the opportunity to fulfill the long-held promise of a new world order where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind." End of the quote by George Herbert Bush. Leading up to the first Gulf War, FEMA had been given amazing authority by a series of executive orders. And I quote, "In the event of a national emergency declared by the President of the United States, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, would be invested with the power to suspend the U.S. Constitution and is positioned to take control of the United States government and its citizens. The authority of 11 preceding presidential executive orders, years 1939 through 1991, has been consolidated into order number 12919. This concentration of executive authority invests FEMA with absolute power over all United States communication facilities, all electrical power, petroleum, gas, fuels, and minerals, whether public or private, all food supplies, agricultural lands, and facilities, all transportation of any kind, including private, and control of seaports, waterways, and highways, all civilian labor forces without regard to financial remuneration, all health, education, and welfare institutions, all airports and air transportation, public, private, and commercial, and all railroads, inland waterways, and public storage facilities." A national emergency? What would constitute a national emergency? Well, in fact, we've been in a state of national emergency following the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, per an executive order by Bill Clinton. And I quote, "On November 14, 1994, by Executive Order 12938, I declare a national emergency with respect to the unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the United States posed by the proliferation of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons and the means of delivering such weapons. Because the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and the means of delivering them continue to pose an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the United States, the national emergency declared on November 14, 1994, and extended on November 14, 1995, and November 14, 1996, must continue in effect beyond November 14, 1997. Therefore, in accordance with Section 202D of the National Emergencies Act, 50 U.S.C. 1622D, I am continuing the national emergency declared in Executive Order 12938. This notice shall be published in the Federal Register and transmitted to the Congress." End of the quote. Is martial law, under whatever guise, being manipulated by terrorism threats? Certainly, even before 9-1-1, the attack on the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, there were clues. TWA 800, downed in July 1996, was shot down by a missile seen by hundreds of witnesses who independently corroborate each other. I quote from the Trouble Times pages on martial law. TWA 800 crash update by the Valley Advocate. The National Transportation Safety Board released thousands of pages of data, charts, findings, figures, and facts on the investigation of the July 1996 crash of TWA Flight 800. To several seasoned military crash experts, these numbers didn't speak, they sang. "I'm looking at the hard evidence," Commander William S. Donaldson, a retired Navy aviator and air crash investigator, told the Advocate. The government is saying one thing and the evidence is saying another. All the physical evidence fits perfectly with an explanation outside of the airplane. Donaldson interviewed 96 people who saw the crash from the ground. All 96, scattered along 11 miles of shoreline, reported seeing a streak of light rise from the surface of the water and merge with the plane before the plane exploded. Additionally, using Global Positioning System satellite technology, Donaldson triangulated the locations of the eyewitnesses and the trajectories of the streaks they reported. The data, he said, suggests they all saw the same streak of light emerge from the water. What's the chance of that being a coincidence? To Donaldson's surprise, federal investigators had not done such an analysis. Donaldson says he finds too much suspicious behavior in the government's investigation to simply write its failure off to bureaucratic ineptitude. I can't believe anybody can be this incompetent, he said. I suspect it's a cover-up, yes. End of the quote. And in the words of an eyewitness, when you fly a helicopter at 120 knots over North Vietnam in the Iron Triangle, in the most heavily defended airspace in the history of warfare, you see a lot of missiles. You see a lot of flak, and I did. I saw a bunch of it. I know what it looks like. My purpose in being here tonight is to tell you that what I saw explode in the sky on July 17, 1996 was a military ordinance. We're here to say it's no accident. Somebody shot this aircraft down. End of the quote by Major Fred Meyer. And the Oklahoma City blast, just previous to TWA 800 on April 19, 1995, had its own evidence of being perpetrated by members within the U.S. government itself. Evidence abounds, including the finding of a leg in military fatigues and a boot found in the rubble, missing the body. Two individuals were tried and found guilty, and the inquiry stopped. I quote from Zeta Talk, "There has been much speculation about the military personnel and apparatus found at the site of the Oklahoma City bombing of a federal building. Clearly, the body of a soldier was removed, leaving behind in the confusion a leg and boot marking the corpse as a military person. Did a subculture within the government plan and execute the bombing, and is a cover-up in place?" Taken in context with the strong-arm tactics used at Waco and used against secessionist-minded families in groups in the western U.S., a pattern has emerged. The brutality of bombing a building which housed a nursery, or shooting a mother standing with a babe in her arms, or rushing a suicide cult holding small children essentially as hostage, has caught the attention of the public. The motive behind this polarization, where the public is led to believe that these strong-arm tactics are necessary, is the same motive that fuels the New World Order movement, control. As the pole shift approaches, panic and riot will increase due to food shortages, but also to alarming weather extremes and earthquakes and volcanism that increase in intensity steadily. Those in the establishment who have planned for their own security and sustenance want to be protected from this panic and the demands of frightened people. Strong-arm tactics, media suppression, and martial law are all cards in the deck of the New World Order crowd, which they hope to be able to play. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Oklahoma City Bombing, written on June 15, 1996. Bioterrorism attacks have also been tried, notably after 9/11. What should be noted is that there was only one source of the anthrax that was mailed about in the weeks following 9/11 that was identified, and this was a CIA lab in Utah. The anthrax strain in the letters sent to Democratic Senators Feinstein and Daschle were from this source. Of course, no prosecution of anyone from that lab ever occurred, the matter dropped. I quote from the Troubled Times pages on martial law. From William Cooper's website, copyright 1997. Since the United States Army's announcement of the inoculation of all of its personnel with anthrax vaccine, I can safely predict that the next large terrorist event within the borders of the United States of America may be biological using anthrax as the agent of destruction and death. End of the quote from William Cooper. William Cooper, of course, was shot to death, supposedly evading a warrant, and was out running around waving a gun, completely unlike him, in view of the fact that he had been the victim of an attempted assassination earlier and carried the gunshot wounds. Everyone takes this to be that William Cooper was shot to death because of what he knew about the plans for biological terrorism by people within the United States government, within the CIA, within the Department of Defense. Was a group seeking dictatorship in the U.S. operating in CIA or Department of Defense labs, preparing bioterrorism tools to be used against their own people? They certainly were practicing. I quote again from the Troubled Times pages on martial law. U.S. conducted open-air biological chemical weapons test, records show. This is from the Associated Press, October 2002. The tests included releasing deadly nerve gas agents in Alaska and spraying bacteria over Hawaii. The United States also tested nerve agents in Canada and Britain in conjunction with those two countries, and biological and chemical weapons in at least two other states, Maryland and Florida. The summaries of more than two dozen tests show that biological and chemical tests were much more widespread than the military had acknowledged previously. And another quote from the BBC. U.S. admits chemical weapons tests. This dated October 2002 also. In large part, the reason for revealing this information now and for briefing the U.S. Congress, as the Pentagon has been doing, is because of concerns expressed by veterans. More than 50 of them have filed claims because of health concerns and fears they were exposed to dangerous substances. End of the quotes. Then, as though to protect the guilty, the innocent were killed. A rash of microbiologists' death occurred in late 2001, as though to ensure the anthrax scare following 9/11 would not be investigated too closely, at least not assisted by any expert witnesses. And I quote, scientists' deaths are under the microscope, dated May 4, 2002. 11 microbiologists mysteriously dead over the span of just 5 months. The first, November 12, 2001, Benito Cuellar was said to have been beaten in a Miami parking lot and died later. The second, November 16, 2001, Don C. Wiley went missing. Was found December 20th. Investigators said he got dizzy on a Memphis bridge and fell to his death in a river. The third, November 21st, 2001. Vladimir Pesetchik, former high-level Russian microbiologist who defected in 1989 to the UK, apparently died from a stroke. The fourth, December 10th, 2001. Robert Schwartz was stabbed to death in Leesburg, Virginia. Three Satanists have been arrested. The 5th, December 14, 2001. Nguyen Van Sett died in an airlock filled with nitrogen in his lab in Geelong, Australia. The 6th, February 9, 2002. Viktor Korshunov had his head bashed in near his home in Moscow. The 7th, February 14, 2002, Ian Langford was found partially naked and wedged under a chair in Norwich, England. The 8th, February 28, 2002, San Francisco resident Tanya Holzmeier was killed by a microbiologist colleague, Guang Hang, who shot her as she took delivery of a pizza and then, apparently, number 9, Guang Hang shot himself. The 10th, March 24, 2002. David Wynne Williams died in a road accident near his home in Cambridge, England. And the 11th, March 25, 2002. Stephen Mosgow of the Colorado Health Sciences Center killed in a plane he was flying near Denver. End of the quote. And certainly, there is continuing talk not only of bioterrorism attacks, but of natural epidemics such as bird flu. Notably, U.S. labs released the virus that caused a pandemic in 1957. They released this virus to 4,000 labs around the world, supposedly by accident. And I quote from New Scientist, "Pandemic causing Asian flu accidentally released." Dated April 13, 2005. The virus that caused the 1957 Asian flu pandemic has been accidentally released by a lab in the U.S. and sent all over the world in test kits, which scientists are now scrambling to destroy. The flu testing kits helps pathologists' laboratories improve their accuracy. The 1957 pandemic started in China before spreading worldwide, killing an estimated 2 million or more people. The virus was sent to laboratories in Belgium, Bermuda, Brazil, Canada, Chile, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Israel, Italy, Japan, Lebanon, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, and the United States. And a quote from ABC News, dated April 14, 2005, "Feds at a loss on how bird flu strain got out to labs." Federal officials are still at a loss to explain how a potentially deadly strain of influenza could be sent to more than 4,000 labs around the world. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is operating under the presumption that the H2N2 strain was purposefully included in the panels designed to test the lab's proficiency in identifying viruses. End of the quotes. And sure enough, those interested in imposing martial law in the U.S. were quick to reveal their plans. From Liberty Post, dated April 1, 2005. Bush authorizes use of quarantine powers in case of bird flu. President Bush signed an executive order on Friday authorizing the government to impose a quarantine to deal with any outbreak of a particularly lethal variation of influenza now found in Southeast Asia. The fatality rate among those reported to have contracted the disease is about 70%. End of the quote. And the Zetas explain the many clues to the plans to use this as yet another means to martial law. And I quote from Zeta Talk, "Pandemic Threats," written April 16, 2005. Bioterrorism has been the mantra of those in the Bush administration since 9/11, with little indication that the terrorists being fingered for 9/11 had any intent to unleash germs instead of bombs. Bombs are a long-standing tool, as are suicide bombers, and using an airplane as a fuel-laden bomb only an extension of this methodology. Germ warfare, as used by Saddam during his battles with rebellious Kurds, has been a tool long present in the arsenal but little used. Was not the anthrax-laden mail after 9/11 perpetrated by Bin Laden associates? No proof of that. But what has been proven is that the anthrax sent to Democratic senators during this scare came from CIA labs in Utah. Despite this signature identification, no prosecution was done and the matter dropped. Saddam, as is a matter of record, got his germs directly from the U.S. when he was an ally during earlier Iran containment battles. If germ warfare was such a threat, then why the casual treatment of the agents? Bioterrorism has become the boogeyman because it is convenient to contain the populace suddenly, should martial law or its equivalent be desired. The Bush administration has run a number of tests to see whether this or that plan or technique might be useful, or to test the gullibility of the American people. We have mentioned the shelter-in-place test, which failed to prove useful as a directive to the public, and the Terry Schiavo test, which failed to dismantle the balance of powers between the branches of government, allowing a Bush dictatorship to prevail in its place. The Patriot Act, supplementing civil liberty checks, has met resistance in many communities and is no longer in favor. With the military in revolt behind closed doors, the Bush administration has only those powers given it by the executive branch, primarily the Homeland Security outreach. What would allow Homeland Security to force the residents of cities to remain in place, to shelter in place, selectively? Infection, affecting those neighborhoods likely to riot and not housing friends of Bush, could be quarantined. Vaccinations, again selected to enhance illness among those not deemed fit for the work camps of the future, could likewise be focused. All that is needed as a catalyst is a pandemic, a worldwide threat, and if nature does not cooperate, then a nudge can be provided. Notable in the recent revelation that a proven deadly virus without natural immunity in the world's populace was released on purpose to thousands of labs in dozens of countries worldwide via standard mail routes is the lack of uproar about this calamity, the lack of major media attention. Notable is the fact that this release came from a U.S. lab. Notable is that Bush recently signed an executive order authorizing quarantine in the case of bird flu epidemic after the release of this 1957 virus and prior to the discovery by the public that the release had occurred. To those who fear being poisoned or contained in camp, we would point to the earth changes, which will overtake those in power long before any planned pandemic can be initiated. Germs will be contained by disaster. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Pandemic Threats. If there is a pattern in attempts to install martial law in the U.S. by manipulating so-called terrorist attacks, there's also a pattern in the Navy's allegiance. What's so special about the Navy? When MJ-12 was formed, shortly after Roswell, it was the Navy that was the branch of the government that was put in charge of the cover-up. The Navy controls timekeeping, and news of the anticipated slowing rotation of the globe as the pole shift approached could thus be contained. The Navy controls the observatories, and thus sightings of UFOs and motherships could be contained, and certainly sightings of the approaching Planet X could be contained. But beyond these issues, the Navy functions under maritime law, which is more in line with what a dictator over the U.S. and its territories might like. I quote from the Troubled Times pages on martial law. The U.S. has technically been at war with its own citizens since the 1930s. The declared national emergency of March 9, 1933, amended the War Powers Act to include the American people as enemies. This allowed maritime law to come onto land. Be careful of that pretty little flag with the gold trim that sits on the pedestal in your courtrooms. That's an admiralty flag, flown on the open seas, not the American flag. The U.S. Constitution allowed for three types of laws: common law, contract law governing contracts and agreements, and maritime law that is used on the open seas to govern our naval forces while out there, since the ships are not on our land. Only in times of war can maritime law govern on land. End of the quote. Of course, we're technically at war, as Bush continuously reminds us, because Iraq supposedly had weapons of mass destruction, and he was authorized by Congress to start an open-ended war with Iraq. And this state of being at war continues. As a result of the 2000 election being stolen from the popular vote by Supreme Court fiat in November 2000, we have this report on its heels in December 2000. The cold, clammy hand of those wanting to impose martial law in the U.S. and in its territories is palpable. And I quote a CNN, U.S. not prepared for domestic terrorism, report says. This is dated December 14, 2000. The United States needs a new White House office for combating terrorism, with a director chosen by the President and confirmed by the Senate, according to a Blue Ribbon panel looking into the U.S. strategy to respond to domestic terrorism. The congressionally mandated panel released its report on Thursday, saying a terrorist attack using a nuclear, chemical, or biological weapon on U.S. soil is inevitable. End of the quote. Boy, it sure sounds like the predecessor to Homeland Security. And the Patriot Act certainly eroded the constitutional rights of U.S. citizens. Electronic snooping and tagging citizens. By early 2003, this was apparent in the U.S. for air travel. And I quote from the chat log, ZetaTalk chat log. What's up with the new regulations on red, yellow, green tagging of all the airline passengers in the U.S.? Is there any connection between this and the FEMA red and blue lists? What criteria will they use to make the color assessments? Criminal records? Dissident groups? Medical history? Financial? End of the quote. And the Zetas explain, and I quote from Zeta Talk, Tagging Citizens, written March 1, 2003. The U.S. touts itself as being the strongest and best example of democracy in the world. This used to be the case up until several decades ago, when its strength was deemed a prize by those humans strongly in the service to self-orientation, and takeovers began. One can trace this demise of democracy in the U.S. back to post-Hitler era, when the CIA was formed of former SS agents. Kissinger befriends Argentina during its purging of protesting citizens. And the CIA is hand-in-hand with corporate greed around the world, toppling elected democracies around the world, installing their cronies as bosses in these countries, and all the while mouthing democratic ideals. Of course, the situation now is patently clear to all, with the takeover of the White House not by vote, but by sleight of hand in orders from the Republican courts to stop the counting. Now, bribery and coercion and the rule of the strong is in play for the whole world to witness. In many countries, repression of citizens with class divisions, registration so no escape from one's lot, is the norm. India has so many classes, they lose count, all rigid. In countries where class is determined by color or race, there is no need to be carrying a card, as the color of one's skin suffices. But in the U.S., among the elite who now think of themselves as world rulers, kings in the aftertime by virtue of the captured military might of the U.S., commandeered by the Bush crowd, such distinctions among white people is not easy. Early attempts to tag all citizens with inserts after 9/11 failed to capture the public's interest, with only a few pets and children so tagged. Even getting immunized has the public leery, with most not eager for inoculations, so this means of poisoning the population seems remote. Martial law is extreme, likely to bring about rebellion, as the complaints about prisoners held on offshore bases and torture and erosion of civil liberties has demonstrated. Thus, the elite in the U.S. have brainstormed as to a solution to sorting out the white population into desirables and undesirables, and have come up with a color-coded system. It is simply not explained to travelers what the criteria is. They are supposed to assume this is akin to profiling by dress or race or body language done in the past, as to whom to search and more thoroughly or not. With the erosion of civil liberties in the name of patriotism, all electronic records, and they have more than the average citizen presumes exist, are to be pooled into the hands of Homeland Security, where they will be used not to protect against terrorism, but to prevent escape from doomed cities, to prevent migration of the undesirable, and to sort out the best workers for the elite to rule over in the aftertime. Or so they presume. So end of the quote from Zeta Talk, Tagging Citizens, written March 1, 2003. Undesirables? Often called useless eaters, these are citizens not deemed good work camp candidates by those wanting a dictatorship in the U.S., with themselves as kings, of course. Certainly the state of one's health would be a criteria for a quick sort, and a health ID card would be just the thing. I quote from the Trouble Times pages on martial law, Feel Like a Number by Robert Gelman, dated August 27, 1998. In 1996, Congress enacted a law that told the Health and Human Services Secretary, Donna Shalala, to select a standard unique identifier for individuals. Identifying individuals reliably and accurately is a problem for every institution. When you apply for credit, a job, welfare assistance, or a driver's license, how does everyone know who you are? Proponents of the health identifier say it would only be used for health purposes, but the protection is a figment. No guarantees from Congress. A recent study by the American Civil Liberties Union in Wisconsin found that of the 50 governmental units studied, 30 maintained identifiable or potentially identifiable health data. Look at what happened to Social Security numbers. The original Social Security card said that it was not for identification purposes, but they are now required to open a bank account, get a job, apply for a credit card, buy or sell property, or obtain insurance. If you want a license for driving, fishing, hunting, or running a business, or if you have a baby, you must disclose your Social Security number. End of the quote from Feel Like a Number. Roadblocks and travel restrictions will occur, checkpoints where the undesirables can be sorted out, or so goes the plan. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Travel Restrictions, written January 7, 2003. Travel restrictions will likely be imposed by governments in response to migrations, but not until this occurs. Thus, this will vary by country, within country, and in truth is in place long before pole shift issues, such as weather changes and increasing starvation, occur. The U.S. has restrictions on immigration from Central America and Mexico, but wetbacks and illegal nannies employed in the U.S. have been a long-standing problem. North Korea is starving, the starving children among the populace creeping into China to raid fields and beg food ongoing for some years. This is controlled not by the Chinese, who themselves are starving, but by the North Koreans, who do not want the world to know of their state. Where sudden homelessness or joblessness is cared for in some manner, in situ, at the site, there will be no migration and no travel restrictions. An earthquake-ravaged city, with tent cities placed on the perimeter and military to prevent looting, will find the majority of the populace in place, waiting for supper and not arguing with their military guards. If a long time running until the shift, months, such a tent city will need to clear travel for those parties who have relatives or second homes elsewhere, and passes will be issued under the guise of a pass so that the military will allow passage, not think the travelers looters. Where life goes on, unaffected by high tides or ravaged by weather or quakes, travel will in all likelihood be similar to today, to seek work or to visit relatives or whatever. Any number of controls may be imposed, and suddenly, based on earth changes. This is one reason to be in your chosen safe location early, and if not possible, to have valid excuses to be there should you need the excuse. End of the quote from Zeta Talk Travel Restrictions. The Zeta Talk on Blockades, written February 8, 2003, rings a chord with the handling of the New Orleans flooding. Those wanting to walk out of the city into the neighboring suburbs were prevented from leaving. This despite a mandatory evacuation order given by the mayor. The reason given, looting of the suburbs was to be prevented, and this meant containment of those trapped in the flooded city. And I quote from Zeta Talk Blockades, written February 8, 2003. Those who want mindless but talented and energetic drones as slaves are concerned. In smoke-filled rooms, in those private after-meeting chats that the power mad have with each other, these issues come up. They have determined that to retain power worldwide requires a few steps that absolutely must be taken and not missed. We will list them as some of the illogical behavior of the power mad becomes clear when these steps are considered. Containment. The elite live in wealthy suburbs, estates, penthouses, and those who they consider their slaves live in ghettos, poor neighborhoods, trailer parks, or in third world countries in mud huts. The issue is keeping the mob in their setting and preventing them from attacking the elite in their enclaves. Thus, containment means keeping them there until the bridges fall, the quaint crumbled buildings fall upon them, and injury and infection take them out. However, preventing escape from cities by bombing bridges, disrupting train schedules, and thus limiting the exodus of the poor and underprivileged from city ghettos is now planned. Enslavement. This plan requires that those healthy and talented among the survivors, of course not the elite, be placed in a position to become enslaved. We have in the past warned against moving to locations offered by the government or the wealthy elite for jobs, work, requiring the family mainstay to move or relocate. Defense. This requires that the elite live in enclaves that are not only in a safe area, but are defensible. Often, the elite have moved into such areas where fences and armed guards or security are present. The elite have planned getaway estate locations. These are guarded by ex-military, ex-CIA, or mercenary types, already hired, whom the elite presumes will be their servants throughout. The mercenaries, of course, will take over and not be gentle about it. Containment is already planned in Indonesia, in Britain, in the U.S., in Australia, but requires a terrorism threat in order to get the military or police or civil units to cooperate. These units, in the main manned by the common man, with family and friends and loyalties not necessarily in line with those of the elite, are already suspicious. Given an order to blockade a city, prevent exit, and institute essential martial law, they would at first obey, but then problems would set in. A blockade only works when it is entirely enforced, and breaches create an exodus that counteracts the blockade, as now those contained are enraged. Thus, we predict that early use of this tactic will create awareness of the tactic, so that later requests for enforcement are poorly implemented and fail. Enslavement has not as yet been implemented, as the economic situation has not become so dire that the elite are willing to admit to this and make such offers. End of the quote from Zeta Talk Blockade. So if FEMA is the primary arm to be used to install martial law in the U.S. and its territories, then why did FEMA fail so miserably during the New Orleans crisis? Why the failure of FEMA to act in any manner that would inspire public trust? The Zetas explain. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Why FEMA Failed, written September 7, 2005. It is no secret that executive orders, long-standing for decades, are poised to give FEMA control of the United States and its territories with the stroke of a presidential pen. The FEMA head is likewise appointed by the president and serves at his pleasure. So who's in charge here? If the president appoints a brainless dolt that allows himself to be led about by the nose, the president continues to be in charge while not having to endure the irritations of living in a democracy where he cannot act like he wants to as a dictator. Is this martial law? It's a broader reach, as FEMA can control every aspect of society by law, drafting workers and commandeering communications, energy, food production and distribution, and transportation. By law, the president can hand the reins of power to FEMA under a threat such as one posed by weapons of mass destruction. Sound familiar? By law, the president can likewise declare martial law under such a threat. But this president prefers to use these forces to commandeer the oil fields of the world. FEMA is a gentler, kinder method of running the U.S. as a dictatorship. Given the obvious desire of those controlling the White House and the U.S. military at present to become dictators, running the world and sitting on top of every oil field in order to control the commodity of the future, black gold, what is stopping them? Cooperation with their plans, for one. These desires are held by a small clutch, numbering in the hundreds at most, who mouth a completely different tune when the microphone is pushed in their faces in front of the cameras. They are a flea riding a restless horse. They know the cataclysms we have predicted so precisely will come and require the element of surprise to complete their plans. The citizenry expect these kind of maneuvers when cities are reduced to rubble by earthquakes or, as in the case of New Orleans, flooded into utter disaster. For FEMA to step in at such a time, exercising restraint in the powers they commandeer, stepping back to allow the normal functions of government to take back the reins, all this builds trust in FEMA, or so the logic goes. The raw hand of greed, the intent to install a dictatorship, should not be revealed too early. Lately, since August of 2003, the military also became a problem, refusing to acknowledge Bush as their commander-in-chief. While not publicly confronting Bush, they foot drag on a buildup in Iraq, on an invasion of Iran, and are leaking information embarrassing to Bush. Control of all but the Navy's nuclear capability has been taken away from Bush and Cheney, the Navy being the only branch remaining loyal to the dictatorship plan. What was it that Poindexter was up to before he was exposed? Snooping on the citizenry. Poindexter, of course, having been excused by Bush Sr. of his crimes during Iran-Contra, a longtime Bush ally. And what is the allegiance of the new NORCOM commander, being an admiral? Navy all the way. But the Navy is not the bulk of the U.S. military, nor is it well in hand, only some of the leadership at the top cooperating with the plan. So where does that leave Bush, who fears an early revelation of his plans, as then cooperation will be eroded, perhaps never to return, and who requires FEMA as a card to be played, as he fears he cannot control the U.S. military? He controls Homeland Security, who controls FEMA, and has installed as the head of both organizations someone he can control. The weak installing the weaker so as to maintain control. Despite the swaggering, Bush has immense insecurity, as anyone cognizant of his cocaine and alcohol abuse and flight from duty during the Vietnam era might infer. He hides from strength, surrounds himself with buddies who are so impressed by his swagger that they remain loyal. What kind of a person is impressed by Bush? Weak-minded into tight command and control without questioning those in authority, rigid and unable to react to anything but the programmed and expected situation. This is why FEMA failed and Homeland Security was as out of touch as the FEMA director. Expect more of the same as disasters increase, as to install any but the weak-minded under him, Bush himself fears losing control. But the game plan is now out in the open, being questioned, the press finally out of their stupor and questioning. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Why FEMA Failed, written September 7, 2005. That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.